Today, who killed the Australian Dream? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance and the Latest, where I've made this post covering finance and property news. Today, I want to look at some of the deep and important issues relating to housing and some of the economic concepts. I'm going to do that with Lisa Barwick from the Citizens Party. Hello there.
Hi, Martin.
Great to see you on. And you've been really, really busy researching through a whole series of papers that you've already published, actually, separately, but on some fascinating issues relating to why are housing prices so expensive, who are to blame for actually that state of affair, what can we do about it? And we sort of go into the whole concept of neoliberalism, austerity, high house prices, central banks and their role. This is a massive jigsaw puzzle, which I think very few people understand. And yet, to me, this explains a lot about where we are. You can't just blame current migration. You can't just blame current government policy. There's a whole history here, isn't there?
Absolutely. And it really relates to the fact that economic policy decision making has been handed to private bankers, usually operating within central banks. You do have to take it back in history, particularly as I've looked at into the period after World War One. Obviously, you can take it back a lot further than that too. But in the period after World War One was the beginning of what today we call neoliberalism, a reinvention of the old British liberal economic system for the current period, and particularly after the war, because during World War One, various governments around the world, to simply to fight the war, had to deploy government credit. And in Australia, we did that in a fantastic fashion with the creation of the Commonwealth Bank, having happened in 1911. And we deployed that method of national credit to transform our nation. We did it even more so in World War II. But yeah, after World War One, it became a point of contention where the Bank of England used a number of conduits, a lot of conduits. It's quite a intricate story of how they went about it, but they ushered in a new policy directive that would ultimately be imposed on nations by central banks. And of course, they had to get nations to accept bringing central banks or creating central banks in the first place, making sure that they were quote-unquote independent in the second place, so that they were run by private people that could be directed by the Bank of England and its adjuncts that came along later, such as the Bank for International Settlements in 1930. Earlier than that, of course, the League of Nations played a key role as the push towards that kind of a global agency, and operating within a club of central bankers, as the head of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, called it, an eclectic club of central bankers, so that economic policy could be determined on a global basis and nations would be hamstrung when it came to developing their economies. And this was something that stemmed back to the British imperial system. In fact, the idea of government banking and national credit had come about after America fought to free itself from the British Empire and won that battle. And the first Treasury Secretary under George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, said, look, you know, we're not going to remain independent if we don't have control of our own banking and finances. And that became a critical element, of course, for the development of the nation, because you can't retain sovereignty unless you're growing and building your nation, including an industrial capacity. And of course, he was famous as well as for creating America's first national bank, for developing the first industrial policy. That's what he's renowned for. King O'Malley here in Australia had modelled himself on Alexander Hamilton. He said in Parliament, I am the Alexander Hamilton of Australia. He was the greatest financial man that ever walked the earth, and his plans had never been improved upon. Of course, though, the British Empire was not happy about losing America, and they wanted to crush this, in nip it in the bud, and a lot of history went under the bridge. But at the point of the after, because Lincoln revived a form of national banking with his greenback, I should say, and built the Transcontinental Railway before the Civil War was even over. And then, even though he was assassinated, that idea spread across the globe. And in the 1890s and coming into the period before World War One, you had across Europe the ideas of Hamilton. He had friends who were advising, for example, the Chancellor of Germany, Bismarck, who knew Friedrich List, a good friend of Hamilton. You had Gabriel Hanotaux in France, the foreign minister. You had in Russia his counterpart, who also was pushing the idea of the Russian railway line, the what's it called? The Trans-Siberian railway line. Count Sergei Vita was pushing that. And these nations wanted to work together to build railway lines and open up corridors across all of Eurasia. Hanotaux in France actually had a whole conception to develop railway across Africa, to open up and develop Africa. I mean, these were part of the reasons for the geopolitical plan that unleashed World War One. And we won't go into that history, but that got us, I'm just saying this by way of introducing how we got to the point of World War One and why after World War One, the ambition of the City of London, which is the little enclave there that houses all the banks and is a, you know, centuries, a thousand-year-old private entity that's actually separate from Britain itself, they were adamant that national credit would not be deployed again, because you can't control a global empire in any form. And of course, the British Empire was over in that form. But over the coming decades, through the two world wars and afterwards, they fashioned what became known as an informal financial empire. But that being said, we're going to talk a bit about housing today as a microcosm of some of these issues and how that doctrine of neoliberalism came to be deployed in Australia and destroyed the capacity of people today to buy a home and own a home.
Yeah, and a couple of observations there. The first is the concept of neoliberalism, which is effectively private capital setting the agenda, driving the agenda. The market is always right, never mind the outcomes. So that is about profit. It's about the private sector maximizing what it can do in terms of profit generation, right? The corollary of that is austerity. What that means is basically, if you can't afford it, you can't have it. And guess what? What happens over time is that public services are diluted more and more and more as more and more and more stuff is outsourced. And that essentially means that, look at the price of electricity now and you know, other services, look at the health and those sorts of things too. So essentially that creates neoliberalism, austerity, two sides of a single coin. And then the housing sector, to my mind, is the absolutely pinnacle of where this has gone dramatically wrong. And if you, you know, want to just put a stake in the ground, this is actually a recent slide that just shows you households' ability to pay relative to the median sale price in Australia, and it's gone way off kilter. Now, of course, it's been tracking the wrong way for some time, but more recently it's gone dramatically wrong. And so the reason why we want to drill into housing is because the current debate on housing is blame migration, blame the lack of supply, etc., etc. But those are just little tips of a bigger iceberg. And so by looking at housing, what we can do in microcosm is to understand why it went wrong, but more importantly, what could be done to bring it back on track again. Because frankly, anybody with a mortgage at the moment, listening to the RBA on Tuesday, who said, well, you know, rates are going to have to be higher for longer. And well, you know, we may even have to put rates up. And we may have to go on a different path to some of the other banks around the real world because inflation is still high. Now, the central bank is driving an agenda, but it's pure neoliberalism. It's purely connected back to austerity. And it's actually, very interestingly, of course, they claim they have no impact on house prices, when of course they do. So this is a really important conversation. So let's pick up the housing in Australia story. And I guess if we go back, you know, a generation or few, Australia was a very small country. We had quite high migration, but there was a completely different approach to housing people coming into Australia than we've got today.
That's right. And also a number of these periods of time that I'll go through were completely defined by the fact that you had world wars going on. So you had a shortage of manpower. You know, our men were overseas. You had an extreme shortage of bricks. I mean, there were sometimes 6 month waits on bricks in the post-World War II period, but all kinds of supplies. And they, some of these housing programs, they considered all kinds of ways and ideas of building and designing houses differently. I mean, at times we were importing prefabricated houses. They tried building houses with concrete walls, which leaked. And I mean, there was a lot of trial and error, but we were in the mode of problem solving because the nation had to be housed. I'm specifically looking at the government's role in what I'm going to go through in terms of house building.
And it's just worth saying, anybody who thinks that housing crisis is a new problem, right?
Yeah.
It's completely missing the point. I mean, there was this example from, I think, 1945, that, you know, harsh reality of housing shortage, right? We must do something. Yeah. You know, this
is amazing going back and looking at some of those.
Yeah. So it's
like, the article and, yeah, people were living in absolute squalor. We had slums in Australia.
Yeah.
They had slum clearance schemes. I mean, you wouldn't think it, would you? Although we might be going back there.
Well, I was going to say, with some of the new construction, you know, you could be arguing the new slums are being built. But the point there was that the politicians in the country at the time realised that this wasn't an acceptable situation. So high levels of homelessness, housing shortage, et cetera, was something that needed to be thought about holistically. Yes. From the point of view of government.
And we did control banks. We had the people controlled banks through initially state banks before we had the Commonwealth Bank in 1911. We already had state banks in most states. And the earliest housing program that was government funded was in Victoria, although Victoria, South Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, and Tasmania were fairly much on par at that time, around 1910. But in the 1890s, the State Bank of Victoria had a program to lend farm credit, and it's called a credit foncier system, whereby, you know, you have a 6 monthly payment and the interest gets totaled and added to that payment or whatever, you know, however you wanted to divide it up. But it was a very, very basic loan, mainly for farmers to, you know, get the agricultural sector going. But then after that, by 1910, the State Bank of Victoria, seeing the housing shortage, started to use the same methodology, and they just switched over and started to make loans available for people to buy homes. But what they also did is they started a state housing agency that would, through the State Bank of Victoria, that would actually build homes. So they didn't only lend the money for the homes, They had architects, they employed inspectors, they organized the contracts, they oversaw the building of it, they certified it at the end of the program. Ads for houses right through into the 40s would have property built under bank supervision on the ads because that was a badge of honor because of the quality of the building and construction work that was done. So yes, this was how the Victorian Housing Agency or the State Bank of Victoria went about it, and they built 5,000 homes in a year in the early 1920s. So they were pumping out homes, as I said, under fairly difficult circumstances. In South Australia, had a similar program, the Advances for Homes Act, that was funded by the State Bank of South Australia. And then, fast forwarding to 1919, after the Commonwealth Bank had been created, the War Services Homes Act was established. And that was to primarily build, they built about 1,700 homes, and over 5,000 homes were purchased to house returned war veterans. And that was directly funded by the Commonwealth Bank at that time, where they would issue loans. The average loan was £800 at 5% interest over 20 to 30 years. Now, then we hit the 1920s, and certain things happened because we had Britain looking over our shoulder. In fact, we had a Royal Commission in 1919 on public expenditure, which was chaired by Sir Robert Gibson, who would later become the head of the Commonwealth Bank and have fights during the Depression in 1930, when he blocked the government from issuing credit that wasn't backed by gold. So that's a whole nother story. But that happened in 1919, where they said, okay, we have to rein in the expenditure. 1920 to 21, there were restrictions put on the Commonwealth Bank issuing banknotes. And then in 1923, our leaders went to an imperial conference where it was resolved that all the nations, well, it wasn't the Commonwealth of that time, but of the British Empire, would establish Commonwealth banks, sorry, central banks. And the central banks, of course, were to be controlled top down. And then in 1924, Sir Robert Gibson came onto the Commonwealth Bank board. And then in 1928, he coordinated to have a British economic mission come out to Australia, to look at the books and try to pull us into line, financially and economically. And as I said, that led into the fight in 1930, where Sir Gibbert, Robert Gibson tried to prevent credit creation. And Sir Otto Niemeyer came down to Australia, who was working at the Bank of England and the Bank for International Settlements, to definitely pull us into line, which led to the Premier's plan and an austerity, budget for all of the states, which was agreed between the federal and state governments. But nonetheless, that aside, we continued with the program. In 1936, the South Australian Housing Trust was created by Sir Thomas Playford, who was the Premier, and he was not a Labor Premier, as you might think. He was a Conservative Premier with the Liberal and Country League. So he was Premier from 1938 to 65. And the South Australian Housing Trust is often cited as a remarkable example of what a government can do, because this agency, which was a statutory agency, was not only about building homes, but it was deployed to develop industry, and like they it was the reason why South Australia has a focus on automotive manufacturing. They were a planning and development authority, rolling out all kinds of infrastructure, even new designing and building new cities. And at the peak of its, because it was largely focused on building homes for people, and they built 122,000 homes throughout the main period of their existence, and they became the state's biggest property developer. And I've seen varying figures that they built anywhere from 30% to 50% of all of the homes in at its peak of home production. So that continued, but all of this was then disrupted by World War II, which, as I said, was a major factor because we weren't focused on that. Although there was a focus on developing industry, and national credit was certainly deployed because it had to be to defend the nation, and that was seen as acceptable by both sides of politics through that period, because there's nothing like war to convince people to open the checkbook, for good or for bad. But by 1942, while the war was still going on, the government was starting to think about housing people when they returned from the war. The Commonwealth Bank Mortgage Department was created in 1942, and that was issuing loans, private loans, to citizens to fund owner builders, so for people to build their own homes. However, it was quickly found that there was still a major gap for the low income earners that couldn't get the deposit that was required and manage the repayments. So that gap had to be filled. And in 1943, Ben Chifley, who was the Minister for Post-War Reconstruction — they were already planning the post-war reconstruction at that time, although the war hadn't ended — he established the Commonwealth Housing Commission. And the Commonwealth Housing Commission conducted an extensive review, where they visited, if I can find the figures here, they interviewed almost 1,000 witnesses, most in person, visited 59 towns, and collected reams upon reams of evidence. And the final report said that, look, we're lacking about 300,000 homes, although later in parliamentary discussions, politicians said, look, that's what we're lacking now, 300,000. We really need to build 750,000, was the figure, because growing populations, immigration, returned veterans, and so forth. But this was the main statement of intent that was in the final report of that commission issued in August 1944. Think about this for today. It said, we consider that a dwelling of good standard and equipment is not only the need, but the right of every citizen. Whether the dwelling is to be rented or purchased, no tenant or purchaser should be exploited by excessive profit.
So, property is a right, right? Property is a human right rather than it actually being something for only those who can afford it.
And that last bit, which no tenant or purchaser should be exploited by excessive profit. Today the only choice you have is getting a loan from a major bank or any bank, and you're going to be paying for it. You're going to be paying not just your mortgage off, but nearly that again over the term of the loan. Where if we returned to public credit, we would be able to make it much cheaper. And there were a lot of fights over the subsequent years when the government established the Commonwealth State Housing Agreement to begin this housing program, because they took seriously what this commission had said about building 300 to 750,000 homes. And one politician pointed out that at that time, the Commonwealth Bank, the cost of it drawing up a loan and everything associated with that loan was about 0.5% interest. So he said, we can be lending to people to buy a home at 1 to 2% interest. That's possible. Of course, today, because of the neoliberal doctrine, even the idea of governments creating credit altogether is anathema. Private banks create credit all the time, every day. But a government can't do it, even though it's acting on behalf of the general welfare of all the citizens that elected it. So this concept has been ingrained in all of our, well, almost all of our political leaders and the population generally, apart from the fact that they think that government shouldn't do anything, shouldn't, you know, build housing, shouldn't run energy. I mean, really, I think that a lot of the failures that we blame governments for are actually because of this program of austerity and neoliberalism, which has taken the control and the power away from governments for many, many decades, in actual fact.
Yeah, and just on that, you can actually look at the statistics, look at long-term home ownership rates. And what's a fact, you know, this chart's really interesting because it shows you that once they got off the ground, this process of the ground, and when they had these big building programs, there was a huge rise in long-term home ownership rates. In fact, home ownership rates hit a high in the late 1950s and has been dropping down ever since. And of course, that's partly because of this change in the atmospherics in terms of who can actually fund and lend. A lot of this was actually publicly built. And that, you know, they were quite innovative too, weren't they, with some of the things they did. For example, the idea of steel-framed prefabrication, dubbed the Beaufort, was built in 1946, right? And that actually was repurposing wartime manufacturing plants. So there was a significant uptick in home ownership, significant innovation, and not just by turning up the wick on saying, well, people must pay more and more and actually have bigger and bigger mortgages, right? So there was a completely different philosophical approach. But even at that stage, there were people who said, no, the government should not be doing this. They should be, you know, out of it. And so there was a big battle and a big debate about the role of the Commonwealth Bank and the role of governments in this. And even back then, the neoliberal seeds were actually still being hatched.
Yes, they certainly were. As I said, the 1920s, you had already had a big injection of that. And after the war, because Curtin and Chifley said, right, you know, we had taken certain control over banking in order to make sure we could run the war effort and direct credit as we needed to direct it. We want to make that permanent. And that's why they put legislation forward, which became the 1945 Banking Act and the 1945 Commonwealth Bank Act. They were rewritten in the 1950s. So today we talk about the 1959 Acts. And of course, as you know, Martin, we've been fighting in this last year or so because they want to, because those 1959 versions were watered down from the 1945 versions, because after Menzies came in, they wanted to neuter the Commonwealth Bank, and they didn't find it fair that a government bank that was also the central bank could operate as a trading bank and compete with the other banks. They wanted the private banks to have a lot more control and say, and of course, it's a matter of history and record that Menzies got elected because of massive amounts of dollars that were pumped in by the banks. And there's a lot of other history to this. But essentially, what we've seen today is the attempt to even further water down that legislation by taking out Section 11 of the Reserve Bank Act, which allows the government to have the final say in a matter of a dispute over monetary policy. Now, we, us, the Citizens Party and our collaborators, you, Martin, many other organisations and people, activist groups, have basically put that bill on ice. It's still sitting there on the list of bills in front of the parliament, but nothing's happening with it because there was a revolt where even people in the Liberal Party said, Hey, even Menzies didn't take out Section 11 because when they re-looked at the legislation in 1959, they actually left that in there because they and a number of Liberal MPs actually said, "Yeah, we want the free market to control everything, but you know there should be this final capacity that the government could override it in the most extreme of circumstances, of course." But yeah, while the because the Commonwealth State Housing Agreement was drawn up in 1945, and there were a lot of debates, as you said, of people on various sides either backing it or saying, oh, this is just socialism, you know, governments shouldn't be involved in building houses and so forth. You know, some of the arguments, for example, Kim Beazley Sr. from Fremantle, from the Labor Party, of course, he cited figures showing that in the state of Victoria, private enterprise had not done the job, and that's why the Victorian Housing Commission had to step in with the State Bank behind it, because yeah, people had said on the Liberal side of the aisle, the private sector will do it. The private sector can do it. You know, you don't have to step in and control things because the Commonwealth State Housing Agreement had said we need to restrict rents. Control rents and keep them at 1/5 to 1/6 of the income of low income earners. And of course, that's not free market. That's not kosher. So there were fights over that. But then, as Beazley said, with luxury home building, maybe the private market would be able to do it. But he said building working class homes cannot promise sufficient profit to induce the massive investment in housing that would be needed to solve the problem presented by a shortage of 300,000 homes. And Sir Thomas Playford even wrote to Menzies, because he had this successful program going in South Australia, which he promoted in that letter. And he said, look, investors won't sink capital into cottages to let them out to the lower paid workers. So he said the states have to provide them. You're not going to get it done any other way. So it went forward. It was voted up, and it was extremely effective. And but the reason it was a Commonwealth State Housing Agreement was that the Commonwealth had no authority to go and build homes in the states because of the way the Constitution was organised. They could only do it with war homes because of the war overriding those issues. So they had to create a funding arrangement where the government could create through a loan agreement money by the issue of treasury bills. So the Commonwealth money would then forward the credit to the state governments, and the state governments would build the homes through the state housing authorities. And in that way, 197,000 homes were built in the first 5 years. As I said, with a lack of manpower, people returned from the war that, you know, were not capable of working immediately, but a very severe shortage of a lot of materials of all kinds, which they had to overcome. And as you said, as a result, from 1947 to 61, home ownership skyrocketed from 53% to 70%. And governments built 24% of new homes in that same time frame. 24% of new homes were built by governments. So that's the program. There's a lot more that could be said about it, and you know, we can provide the links for people to read more of the detail. But one of the things, of course, that happened thereafter was that when Menzies came into power in 1949, and he'd been funded by the banks, there was payback. And there's a speech that I read in Parliament from, I think it was the 1959 debates over the Reserve Bank Act, where this particular politician who I'd never heard of before went through chapter and verse of the control by that time of the banks over all of the media and various other industrial groups and so forth. So already that control was beginning to exert itself in a major way. And the funding mechanisms started to change from that point, and in fact had already started to change after the war, because Ben Chifley, and this was also the at the same time, and I'm only beginning to research and look more into this now, there were changes and reorganizations that were taking place in the Treasury after the war in 1946, and there were advisors that were even, it appears, were pulling Chifley away, even, who was, not an expert in finance, but an engine driver. And the Chifley governments, they were utilising the issue of Treasury bills through the Commonwealth Bank to create national credit less and less. It dropped significantly after the war. And then when Menzies came in, it dropped even more. And of course, you had this was the early 1950s with the Korea War, inflation was hitting, and austerity hit full swing at this point. And you can actually put up a graphic, I think, that you've got there showing that, because the Commonwealth Bank was putting restrictions in on its lending, and the private banks also were doing the same thing, following the queue. But the terminology that was being thrown around at the time was that the Menzies government was entering a credit restriction policy, which is just another name for austerity, which had been, and I can come back to the details of where that policy originated later, but essentially it was the tightening the belt. In the, national credit creates inflation, so you can't do it. Of course, if you're using the credit to build industry, increase productivity, it's not going to increase inflation at all. And I mean, that's been proven many times over. But that was just the black and white, you can't create credit or you'll get inflation. That had been created through the 1920s period in Europe, by the Bank of England and its adjuncts, the League of Nations, and they had run pilot programs which started in Britain itself, where they had an austerity policy straight after World War II, which didn't work. Unemployment went through the roof. They sent people from the League of Nations into Austria and signed them up to the program in order to, after the war, they needed loans. And so there was an Austrian protocol, and the League of Nations sent their men into Austria. They actually had a guy that went and moved there and lived there, and he would even walk out on the train platforms and say, "That guy, we don't need him. He could be sacked." I mean, they just pulled apart the public sector. They scrapped half of the government departments, slashed money for healthcare. Again, it didn't work. Unemployment went through the roof. Most of the loans went into speculation. It led to the financial bubble that led to the collapse in the 1930s, ultimately, with Kreditanstalt sparking that crisis, which was Austrian. And the same policy, another one of the pilot programs, was in Italy. The policies of Mussolini were all based on that same pilot program from Britain. And before coming to power, Mussolini had been on the MI5 payroll. He was promoting propaganda to keep Italy in the war. And his policies, like he was one of the first world leaders to usher in a mass privatization program. From matches to highways, and the first public private projects to have public money to help build highways that were then, they took the money, the earliest toll roads, as you see there, went to into the private purse. And so, there's a lot of detail there, but that this was the origin of the austerity plan, and it was all mapped out in terms of fiscal tightening, monetary policy, budget cutting, but also industrial austerity. So, don't let wages rise. And one of the things that came out of, there was two conferences in the 1920s at The first one was in Genoa, and the second one was in Brussels. And this was where the Bank of England expanded upon this doctrine. And one of the things they said was that after World War One, people, I mean, during, you know, they even during the war, they blamed inflation on too much consumption, you know, excessive consumption of butter and sugar and so forth. But then they also said that after the war, people's pay packets, you know, went up, and the poor people had too much money to spend. You know, because during the war, we had, you know, nations had put funding, government funding towards building industry because they had to. And so that kind of had an after effect where people were better off despite all of the tragedies of the war and everything else. And unions, you know, started proliferating and so forth. And yeah, you can find quotes from these conferences where they were saying we have to rein in, we have to have compulsory thrift programs for the poor to make sure they don't spend money. That was going on. But never did it work, as I said, and there's countless examples where you can show that that kind of a policy in the end, because you shrink the economy, unemployment goes up, and you just end up in a worse position than what you were in.
So just a couple of observations there. It's interesting how the British have their fingers all over this, right? So wherever you see this, right? I mean, you know, there's a photograph here from one of the big conferences, the Genoa conference, right, with British PM Lloyd George at the front. So, you know, it's sort of front and center. And the point there is an ideological standpoint here, which is going directly against the idea of there is a role for governments to help, for example, with housing and other investment to be able to build the infrastructure for society, right? The alternative is to say, no, we have to actually compress and put pressure on the working class, you know, the ordinary person. We can't allow them to spend. But the corollary of that is that actually at the top end, you can allow them to expand their wealth and do all of those really interesting things. And you know, this is real, real important stuff insofar that if you look back earlier in history, you know, JP Morgan, the person, not the bank, they're there too, right at the start of this whole idea of the neoliberal worldview, which essentially says we've got to privatize wealth creation, we've got to maximize wealth creation at the top end so the rich get really richer. But at the bottom end, ordinary people, well, you know, they're just going to have to, you know, basically the ratchet has to get tightened. And that is precisely what we are seeing now, right? So all of the conversations about, oh, we need to dampen inflation, we need to, you know, squeeze inflation out of the system. Who is it hurting? It's hurting those people who are aspiring to own a home or to rent a home. So there is a fundamental philosophical disconnect between the neoliberal thou shalt create wealth at the top end and what we're talking about here, which is the way that in the 50s and 40s in the 50s in Australia, housing actually worked and more people than ever before owned their own properties, right? And rents were controlled to an extent that allowed people to allow them to live. So we have got this huge pull between neoliberalism one side of the fence and, you know, a little bit more of a stronger role for governments to sort of do things. Unfortunately, what has happened over the last 50 years in particular is neoliberalism has won out. So if you look at the deregulation of the banking system with Commonwealth Bank basically sold off, you know, its role as the central bank taken away, then sold off. We've got a separate reserve bank now, the RBA. But the RBA is one of a number of central banks that actually sits under the you know, informal auspices of the Bank for International Settlements, and we could go into a lot of detail about just how great or not the BIS is in terms of the way that it does things and its philosophical background. But what's been created here is a series of events where this idea of neoliberalism has expanded the role of banks, in the private sector banks in particular. It's allowed them to actually lend even more, so it's reduced the multiples against which income is allowed to be lent at, which is one of the reasons why prices have gone up incrementally much higher than incomes. And today it's disastrous. And who are the winners? The winners are the money power, the people at the top of the tree, the big banks, and all of those. And okay, people will say, well, my superannuation is invested in the banks, so don't I get some benefit? Well, you do, but only incrementally. And by the way, in the superannuation mechanism, who are the winners? $30 billion to $40 billion of fees every year taken out of the superannuation system that goes back into the banking system. Well, guess what? There's a sort of an unequal struggle here. So we've got the situation where house prices have got out of kilter because the neoliberal philosophy through the banking systems and processes have been allowed to run roughshod over everybody else. And yet even now we are talking about controlling inflation by throttling people's ability to spend. So you can see here that this is becoming a really stark political choice. And that's why, of course, there's a lot of opposition to the idea of creating a government bank that can actually, for example, provide loans at lower cost to people, that could actually invest in infrastructure that we can't seem to afford to pay around the world. So it's an ideological struggle that we're talking about here.
That's exactly right. I mean, I call austerity economic fascism because, as you exactly explained, it's a means of looting the people so that the current system can survive. We saw that after 2008. We've seen it ongoing, and it's going to get worse with a new crisis. It's inevitably building because we haven't solved the problem from the first instance. To close off on the housing part of it, so by the time Menzies came in and the banking influence through the neutering of the Commonwealth Bank had, you know, gotten its top-down grips into the government. As I said, the Labor Party had already less and less used forms of national credit to fund it. When Menzies came in, he started to then just float public loans and use tax revenue. And it's interesting because if you read my austerity document, that was exactly what the British specified in the austerity program, that new credit could only be issued if it was drawn from the savings of the population. So if you floated a loan and people purchased those bonds, that's okay. Or increasing tax revenue, increasing regressive taxes so that the poor people, you know, who have these fat pay packets now, spend less of it and we'll sucker it from them. So that was what Menzies did. And of course, it drove up the costs of loans immediately, because if you're going to float a public loan instead of issuing a national credit loan, you've got to have an attractive interest rate to get people to buy it. So already you've got a higher rate. And the other thing that I found reading the debates after 1945 in the 1950s, when they were renegotiating the Commonwealth State Housing Agreement, is that the government, Menzies government, had to say a number of occasions, well, the states requested this amount of money for housing, but the market could only come up with this amount. So they weren't able to, float all those loans successfully. Not enough funding was available. So one of the things that the Menzies government did was they encouraged two things. They encouraged the state governments to sell the existing public homes, which was good for home ownership. And there's nothing wrong with that approach. Something similar to what Singapore does, actually, because you've got 90% home ownership in Singapore. 80% of them, or 80 to 90% of them, are publicly built homes. The government builds them and then sells them. But at this stage of the game, for Australia, we didn't have enough. And the second factor was that the Menzies government progressively reduced the amount of funding that they were putting into the housing program. One, because as I said, they couldn't get the funds for it. And secondly, because they were diverting, they diverted 20 to 30% of the money for the housing program into building societies to provide funding for private owner builders. Again, nothing wrong with that, but at this stage, it diverted money from the public program to build those desperately needed homes for the lower income earners. The other thing that started to occur around this time was that you started to hear the arguments with the neoliberal tenets saying, oh, it's not fair that low wage earners get this advantage. You know, that's not fair. And the other thing that wasn't fair was that government were getting an unfair advantage over private developers. So these housing authorities had an unfair advantage over the private developers, you know, which is sort of the precursor of competitive neutrality. You can't allow a government agency to compete with the private sector because it's got an unfair advantage. I mean, it's good for all of us if you do, but it's not good for the money that for the elite that was siphoning off the money to. It doesn't extend their system in the way they wanted. And this led into other things like the Menzies government starting to come up with other ideas, such as tax incentives for people building homes, for private developers and so forth, which then by the 1970s had begun to fuel what would become the housing bubble of today, because, you know, all those kind of means of incentivizing the building of homes, people found out that they could make a profit out of that. And all the various other tax cuts that came along later. And I'll just mention too.
Sorry, just before you go on, that's, I want to underscore that. This whole concept of using the tax system to try and actually, you know, warp the housing market, which is what they've done, that's a fundamentally neoliberal philosophy again, right? Because it's effectively saying, well, we're going to pull this. And that's why when we've now got the situation where most property investing people are actually in the private sector, individuals, right, with their own tax breaks and benefits. And so one of the reasons why we have a housing crisis now is because of the idea of the taxpayer should subsidize, directly or indirectly, those private investors. So again, private market. You know, let the market be the market, you know, let them go and borrow some money from the banks and negatively gear and leverage up.
Yeah.
It's all part of that same philosophical idea. And now we've got to the point where the government is now saying, well, we actually need to encourage people to build to rent. So they're actually now talking about tax incentives to private corporations who are going to build properties to rent out. But if you look at what the rents will be, they're quite a lot higher and they're getting tax breaks and they're also putting more and more pressure on the government to give them more commercial benefits. So once again, you can see how the commercial agenda is cutting across the housing agenda. And the final point I wanted to just, you mentioned people selling off. Maggie Thatcher, you know, she actually had a massive selling program so people could buy their own council houses, but there was no replacement program.
Yeah.
So effectively, the proportion of housing that was available for ordinary people who couldn't afford to play the market game got smaller and smaller and smaller. And sure, there's a little bit of housing association activity around the edge, but there is nothing like the intent that there was previously when housing was seen to be fundamentally a human right, not an investment vehicle. Mm-hmm. And the natural fallout from neoliberalism is that property is seen to be another asset class, another speculative class, another thing that people can make money on. And there you go. That's why we've got to where we've got to in the current crisis.
And interestingly enough, because that's the point I was just going to make, talking about it being a human right, it was in the 1970s, after all these shifts to the free market that we just talked about, that a shift came that began the stigmatization of social housing or welfare housing, because Chifley had had housing under the Ministry for Works and Housing. That's what it was. But under Menzies, it was put under the Social Services Ministry. And it was then over time segmented so that it was it, there were programs for Aboriginal housing, pensioner housing, crisis accommodation. So as they do with everything, they kind of splinter it up and it becomes for these selected groups only. It's not a general human rights or social issue at all. So it went downhill from there. And of course, today we are where we are. But the thing is, we know how to do this. We can do it on scale at a major. We could solve this problem. It'll take effort. It'll take money. But we know how to fund it if we choose to do so. And of course, you know, our political party is pushing for a people's bank of one kind or another, and it could operate through the post offices to save the post offices at the same time to keep them going, as many other countries have done by taking banking on through the postal service, because the footprint is so big, they're everywhere. And what we've found, funnily enough, is that this is not something supported just by the kind of left-wing types, but by the right-wing types too. In fact, a big businessman, a Liberal fellow the other day, told us the government needs an economic tool, not just for housing, but for dozens of things. And we don't have that capability because it was taken away throughout this history that we've, you know, giving you just the very tip of the iceberg of through the policies of austerity and neoliberalism, and putting central bankers in charge, technocrats in charge of economic policy in favour of keeping an imperial financial architecture in place rather than fostering the sovereignty of nations that are looking out for the people of that country.
Yeah, and two observations there. The first is, of course, when Commonwealth Bank was actually a public bank, it granted loans to local councils for the development works like building hydroelectric dams and canals and providing generators for reliable power and electrification of industry. So it wasn't just housing that they were actually investing in. It was actually a broader set of infrastructure that was there to lay the foundations for society. The other point I just want to come back to, because we've sort of sidled around the central bankers, you know, story. And I just want to come back. Politicians, of course, are walking away and saying, oh, it's nothing to do with us. It's the central banks. You know, they are the technocrats. But this technocratic idea, which is a top-down view, and, you know, mentioning back again on the Bank for International Settlements, you know, the BIS is the bankers, but what they are is a club. And they are a club that have a very particular neoliberal way of thinking about things. So guess what? All of the central banks around the world are pretty much dancing the same tune, right? Which is essentially to say, no, we can't, you know, we got to pull inflation down. We've got to stop people. We've got to crush economic activity until inflation is actually won. But that is an artifice that has been created by this top-down structure that then comes down into the various countries around the world, including Australia, the UK, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got the local banks, effectively the central banks, doing the same thing, dancing the same tune. But actually, and Gerard Rennock has highlighted this many times in the Senate, you know, there are roles for the central bank to do some of the things that we're talking about if there was the will to do it. So it actually doesn't come down to an economic question. It comes down to a political will and intent question, which is precisely where this idea of a public bank comes in, because there is an alternative path, and that alternative path was proved successful a couple of generations ago. So we've gone on this neoliberal, you know, mayhem. The winners, the money power, the losers, ordinary people, but there is a path that can be trod if in fact there was an intent. And the interesting observation, as you said earlier on, not just the left wing, but also on the right side of politics. Mm. There's an acceptance that we need to find a different path. And by the way, it doesn't necessarily mean issue lots of bonds out into the marketplace, which is what, of course, central banks can do. There are other ways of funding it too. So there are models that could be adopted. So the critical point to take out of all this conversation is, who killed the Australian dream? The neoliberalists, those money powers, those international entities that come top down and say, no, this is the way you should do it, rather than actually do it for local people and local communities. And so there's a really critical choice ahead about how we define the future success of Australia and other countries too, and to what role will the finance system play in this. I think we should put finance back in the box, and we should be focusing on the idea of using the structure of the banking system, in particular public banks, to enable some of the things that we need to invest in to be invested in. Because without it, there isn't much of a future unless you are very rich.
That's right. Yeah. If we want to destroy the power of the money power, you have to take the power of money away from them. And I think you make a good point that while you do that, you take it away from them, you can't let money be the power at all. You have to look in an economy at what needs to be done. And money is just a footprint of certain processes that need to be done.
It's not an end in itself. That's the critical point, right? It is enabling capability rather than end in itself. And if you look at all of the news stories about stock markets going up and down and, you know, et cetera, and the number of billionaires, right? That is all a false set of signals for success, right? The true level of success is the measure of how many people can afford to have a reasonable place to live and have a reasonable lifestyle and all of those things. Have we got a health system that's working effectively to provide the level of support that people need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And on those critical measures of success, if you compare it now with a few generations back, we've actually gone the wrong way.
We've actually failed miserably by that measure.
Exactly right. So it does come back to how you measure success. GDP is not the answer, postscript. You know, that doesn't necessarily measure anything useful, and GDP per capita has gone backwards, absolutely. But when you talk to ordinary people, what I find is that they are really frustrated with the way that things have gone, but don't really understand why they've gone wrong. So hopefully what we've been able to do today is to explain at a very high level some of the history that explains how we've got into the mess we've gone into. But the good news is there is actually a way forward, which if enough people actually sort of get behind it, could really make a big difference. Now, you've published a whole series of articles on your website. We'll put the links and things below for people who want to delve into this. We've only touched the surface here.
Yeah.
And we've already been going an hour. But we thought it was important to try and sort of join the dots, because if you only understand where you've come from, that helps to understand where you can go in the future. And if you don't understand the past, then the future is a mystery too. So I want to say thank you very much. Any last thoughts before we sign off?
No, just to reinforce what you said, it's seeing the causality for these things. If you know what's caused the problem, then you don't fear what it is. It's just, as Marie Curie said, nothing in life is to be feared. It's only to be understood. And if we don't understand things yet, and some things, you know, take a bit of grappling with and digging through history. But once you understand it, you can begin to get on the pathway to figuring out the solution, because there's a solution out there for every problem. Just applying our minds to it and applying our population. And once people have a home to live in and a decent wage, we can put much more manpower to that cause.
Yeah, and I always say, you know, believe it or not, the future is actually still open. There are still options. There are alternatives. But actually, just repeating the mistakes of the last 30 years and assuming a different outcome well, that's not going to work, is it? We're just going to go through another inflationary cycle, and more people are going to be in more difficulty. So there are alternatives out there. And I suppose, if anything, by way of a takeout from here, we know what caused the death of the Australian dream, but the dream can be revived if we actually take a different path. And there are paths that can be taken.
And neoliberalism is taking a hammering. It really is. So we're finding with politicians, everyone we talk to, from the highest ranks to the lowest, people know it stinks. They just don't quite know what the alternative is, but that's what we're why we're getting the word out.
Absolutely. Well, I want to say thank you very much for all the work you've done, the research, and also for taking the time to go through it with me on the show today. And I'm sure there'll be other things we're going to talk about, because we could go into a lot more detail about the deficiencies of the BIS and, you know, all those things. But the point is, hopefully we've joined a few dots and given people some hope. So thank you very much indeed.
Starting point. Yep. Well, thank you, Martin.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.